There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MEATEATER for 10% off your purchase.
You know what my favorite text is? A waypoint in the Onyx Hunt app to a goblin turkey. The list on the Onyx Hunt app features for chasing turkeys is long, but knowing exact public and private boundaries and land ownership details will help you find more places to hunt, whether that's on public or private. I'll be toting the Hunt app through the spring woods in a few states this year, and I recommend you do the same if you want more turkeys on your table. Also, Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt this spring. My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is a production of the Bear Grease Podcast called the Bear Grease Render, where we render down, dive deeper, and look behind the scenes of the actual Bear Grease Podcast. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore.
Well, welcome to the Bear Grease Render Podcast. So for anybody that is new to this, the Bear Grease world, the Render Podcast is where we talk about the Bear Grease Podcast. Bear Grease Podcast is a documentary style podcast, Brent, right?
Am I right? Agreed.
And so the Render is where we gather up an eclectic crew of usually just like gritty Americans that come in here and we talk about last week's podcast. Man, I'm pumped about the eclectic group of people that we have here today. So I'll do my introductions. To my left, Brent Reeves, looking sharp, brother.
Always clean socks.
Good.
One right, one left.
Good. Man, you're This Country Life. So Brent's the host of This Country Life podcast. We'll come back to that.
Okay.
To your left, two brothers that you guys are like legends in my world. I mean, I'm not kidding. I'm going to tell you why.
I've got low standards.
I've got Andy and Aaron Stanfill here today. Aaron was a storyteller on the Deer Stories podcast, and he's going to have another story on the next podcast. But let me describe how I know these guys. I went to prison.
That's
in 2003.
I knew it.
No. So I was, one of my heroes, and still is to this day, is Scott Brown. Scott was like 4 years older than me, which is the perfect age to idolize somebody and to kind of be influenced by who they are. Scott went to the University of Arkansas. I get married. My first married home was in Fayetteville. I start working, and Scott was from my hometown. Me and Scott start working together. We just worked the same place. And by that time, Scott had knew you guys and was hunting with y'all. And he talked about you guys like y'all were just like the best hunters that ever lived. He did. And so I believed him back then. No. Do you remember one time, Aaron, I rode in the truck with you and Scott to go hunting? I was just like a little pipsqueak. It was just like,
was
it's just like, Brown, who's this guy? Why is he here? That's the way I felt being around you.
It seemed like us group of guys, we hunted all the time. Me, Lucas, Scott, we went to the management area 3 days a week. So you may have been on one of those trips.
Yeah, I was. I remember it. See, you don't. But
didn't you come to our camp 1 year?
Well, yeah, I did. So that would have been after that, probably the same year.
Okay.
Y'all camped in some public ground over here, and I went to the camp, and it was all the guys. I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me go ahead and introduce the whole crew so our buddy here can jump in. To Aaron's left is my dad, Gary the Believer Newcomb. How's it going, Dad?
Really good,
did you hear your
man.
Name come up in the podcast a couple
yeah,
times?
Yeah, man, I love it. I'm getting almost as famous as old Render Man over here. Render Boy.
Render
yeah.
Boy.
Yeah. You agreed with me, too, didn't you? You knew it was the Black Panther that stole Moe's buck.
There's no question about that. I mean, everybody knows that the regular cougar won't go up a tree.
Yeah, of course.
You got to be a black course. One.
Had to have been a black one. Like that just one like that been. One right there. You see our Black Panther over there, Andy?
That's nice.
Yeah, that's a nice touch. So, to Dad's left, Lucas Alston. Luke, good to have you, man.
Thank you.
So, Luke was a storyteller, too. He hit a home run on the last story on this first episode.
He did. It was fantastic.
It really was. And I told it. So Luke, I've known you most of my life, but our circles never, they overlapped briefly.
Like, yeah, because you're enough younger than me. And then when you and Scott, when you came to Fayetteville, it was about the time I was leaving Fayetteville.
Right.
And but I remembered you as a young pup, your dad bringing you the bow shoots. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, you as a youngster. And I remember, so I've known you. When you said long time, that's accurate.
Yeah. You know where I remember your face most, Lucas, was on Polaroid pictures at the bow shop. For real.
Oh, killer. He's killer.
There's just some things you just remember.
Yeah.
I remember seeing, you know, this guy 4 or 5 years older than me that was killing deer and hogs and stuff. I feel like I remember there was a picture of you with a hog down mm-hmm. there. So anyway, just stuff you remember. But no, I told Luke that a lot of times for what I'm trying to do in a stories podcast, a sentimental story is a hard one to pull off. And I'm glad I didn't tell him, I'm glad I didn't coach him because I just trusted him that he would know how to handle a story. I often coach people not to tell sentimental stories.
Facts.
Because everybody's got one and they don't always translate. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yep.
I mean, I'm not trying to be like mean or
sure.
something. But like everybody's got a story about when their kid's first deer or this or that. And a lot of times it's super meaningful to you, but it as far as entertainment value, it's hard to translate. He knocked it out of the park
yep.
with this one.
He
like
did.
The
yeah.
the I meant it when I said sitting there listening to you tell the story, I was like, take that gun away from that boy, shoot that deer, and then Ryan gives him the gun, and I'm like, oh dang, I was a little upset. I was like, shoot. I didn't really want him to take it. And then he gets the bead, and I'm like, yeah, he's about to shoot that buck. And he's like, nope. And I'm like, no, Luke, don't give it back to him.
Back when I knew Luke, he'd have shot the two does that came out first.
Yeah. That's, I never got there.
That's why I made the statement that I have not always been this way. Because, when Aaron and I run around together, there was nothing safe with me. And, but things have sure changed.
They sure have.
A lot of things have changed.
Mm-hmm. And, to go back. So Lucas, Aaron, and Andy, y'all all knew each other real well for years and years. Aaron, tell me how you met Lucas.
I was a sophomore or a junior, probably a sophomore in college, went to the University of Arkansas. And right the first week, I walked into a computer class. I don't even remember what the class was called, but anyway, I walked in there and I was lost and was just trying to find somebody that looked like me, you know, to sit by. And I saw an old boy sitting over with a High Country archery shirt on.
That's a mark right there, ain't it?
I thought, I'm going to go sit by him.
Yeah.
And anyway, we become best friends immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was it.
And we were peas and carrots
after that. So yep.
In our deer camp the next fall.
Yes. Yeah.
Now, that brings up an interesting name, High Country. When you told that story to me the other day, what the High Country used to be, this is a little bit of a rabbit trail, but Dad was a big High Country man back in the day. Yeah. High Country was the top of the line bow in the 1990s.
Yes, it really was. Yeah. It was hard to beat. It was fast, good looking. It was.
I'd like to do a marketing inquiry and a business like to understand what happened. Because they were so big, the name was so good, the bows were so good, and today, I think they're actually still in business. I think they're still in business, but they're like not a major player, unfortunately.
That'd be interesting to find out mm-hmm. what happened.
You know, I would bet they bought an airplane.
What do you mean?
Damn, what do you mean? A lot of companies.
Yeah. Tell me what you mean.
Well, it's kind of a deal.
That's
in
a
banking.
Banker
you know,
right there,
if,
buddy.
If you get your, you know, you, first time you really get in a big bucks, you want an airplane. And sometimes you buy it about 10 years too early.
Yeah.
Mic drop moment from the old banker. Bought an airplane. What kind of High Countries did you have?
Oh, I had
Excalibur.
Yeah. I had several, and I blew a lot of them up. You know, I got one shooting 340 feet per second back when guys were shooting 220. You know,
yeah.
And I almost won a big archery tournament with it because I could shoot out to 40 yards pretty flat. Mm-hmm. I mean, you put it at 40 yards and just come up 2 inches and wacko. And, it was pretty amazing. Took it home, and I thought, I'm going to go to this really big shoot down in South Arkansas and whip a bunch of fannies. And I pull my bow back in the backyard, and both limbs just folded up. And I never went to another tournament until, you know, Louisville got me to go to a tournament 1 year out at his house. Mm. And so I just quit tournaments after that.
Mm. There was a bow shop in Warren, and this would have probably been, man, it was way early. It was late 80s, maybe 90 at the most. And they had a 70-pound High Country in there. And I knew the guy that run the bow shop, and he said, man, you got to shoot this thing. I said, what's it set on? He said, 70 pounds. I said, oh, yeah, I can pull that back. I was worried I wasn't going to have children for a long time. That was the hardest. That thing was stout, buddy. I mean, you had bows back then, a 70-pound bow pulling back today and one back 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. I guess it's been 30 years, ain't it?
Mm-hmm.
It was a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. I remember that was my first introduction to High Country. That was a man's bow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man.
I didn't get one.
Andy, when did you start bow hunting?
1995, I believe. So I was 15 in 95.
How much younger? Aaron's the older brother.
I think there's 3.5 years between us.
Yeah.
So I just basically wasn't strong enough to shoot a compound bow until, you know, 95, really. I shot a crossbow there for a couple of years and started bow hunting in 95.
Mm.
And that was the first year that I hadn't even killed a deer before then at all and hunted a lot. And I think in the podcast last week, Aaron, you mentioned, you know, how hard it was to even kill a deer with a bow back then. You know, I don't know if it was just a lack of experience or what it was, but I was hunting hard out there and just, you know, wasn't seeing the number of deer. And anyway, that first year that I started bow hunting in 95, I killed my limit. I limited out that very first year. And so, yeah.
95.
Yep.
95. Dad brought up an interesting name there that came up on the podcast, Louisville. Louis, if you've listened to the Bear Grease podcast, you know who Louisville and Charlie Edwards are. I actually went back and listened to all three of those episodes from early in the Bear Grease world on Louisville and Charlie because on this episode, Louisville and Charlie came up. You probably knew them pretty good, didn't you, Lou?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because
you know, coming from a dog hunting family, you know, there were just certain areas of dog men, you mm-hmm. know, and you knew not to go that way with your dogs because the Edwards, you know, that was their territory. We had our territory. And, you know, and back then, yeah, everybody had a pen full of dogs. And, of course, my family was similar to what Travis Ross said. They run his dad, Gene, and my dad and uncle and all them run in the same circles. You know, fox and wolf hunting was the main thing. And then they just ran deer when season opened. It wasn't that they had specific deer dogs. They just had running dogs that would run a deer.
You told me how many dogs your dad and uncle had at one time.
Between my dad, my uncle, and my grandpa, it was not uncommon for us to have 50 hounds.
Hmm.
And when I say 50 hounds, I'm talking 50 walker running dogs, not tree. They were specific to running coyotes and fox and deer. And so I grew up in that. Still hunting was not in my family.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of broke the mold with still hunting. You know, in my dad's generation, there were no deer. Kind of like Andy Brown talking about his dad, Barney, who I knew as a young man. He was a character, let me tell you. And if you were offended by language, you would get offended quickly in his presence. But he was a good man. Love them July hounds, and Andy even mentioned, you know, his dad casting them Julys. Well, I come from a family of folks that hated Julys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If it wasn't a walker, it wasn't worth having.
Now, but a July is a walker.
Not in my world.
Okay.
Not in my world, they weren't.
But they were a tri-colored white, black, and brown dog.
Yep.
Would they have looked any different?
They were built basically the same.
But there was a difference.
You could tell by looking at them if it was a walker, if it was July.
What would a July would be? Sleeker, thinner?
Not necessarily. Maybe, but more their coloring. They'd be more of a yellowish color.
They didn't have a lot of white on them. You said
no. Really? They were not black, white, tan. They were kind of yellow, black, tan.
Okay.
But it is always fun to listen to them old timers, you know, fuss the July men versus the Walker men. Yep. I mean, it was a dividing line. It was just like OU and OSU. If you're if you're a Sooner fan, if you're a Cowboy fan, you know, you could get in a fight quick.
Mm-hmm. Now, Travis said something that I would have qualified, but I kind of just let it go. He said his dad was a fox and wolf hunter.
Yes, sir.
Which we all know, and he knows it too, that there hadn't been wolves around here for 100 years.
Right.
Or probably 130 years.
But that was what everybody referred to as, you know, I guess back in the original days of whenever it was, 130 years ago or whatever, however long ago it was, we did have wolves. And but when you hear somebody talking about fox and wolf dogs, that's what they're talking about is coyotes.
Coyote dogs.
Yeah. And, yeah, it was kind of just a given. I knew he was talking about running coyotes.
Yep.
And he did too.
Yeah.
Fox and wolf hunter.
Yeah, if you see the associations around the state still to this day, they don't say fox and coyote. It's fox and wolf. Fox and wolf hunter associations, yeah.
Huh.
At least the ones I'm familiar with.
Dad, did you know Barney Brown, Andy's dad?
I did not.
He died in the mid-90s, maybe.
Yeah. We were pretty young. Scott and I were, there's about a year difference. Scott and I, he was probably 10 or so when his grandpa passed. He loved his hounds probably more. I mean, you've probably heard Andy say this very thing, that the dogs ate before the family did. I mean, he cared for his dogs, and because they put meat on the table, you know, it was kind of a net. It was a tool.
Yeah.
And
does any of your family still run dogs?
They do not. Most of my family's gone. My uncle still living, but in poor health. And he was the sure enough dog man.
And who was that?
Everybody's going to know him as Dude Alston.
Okay.
his handle, his CB handle, is the Watchmaker.
Okay.
he worked at Thomas Jewelry and had his own jewelry store for years, and his trade was working on watches.
Okay. Okay. Are you a little bit sad that that's gone?
I am, because some of my greatest memories of my previous generations, my father, my grandfather, my uncle, and all those guys, that a lot of them have passed on, are memories that were made with dogs. And it was a totally different kind of hunting. And I know for folks that have never done it, it might have been controversial. It was never controversial for me. I understood.
Yeah.
You know, I understood the game. Because I saw the love and respect that my family had for their hounds. And the feeling, two totally different feelings that you get from running dogs to still hunting. Running dogs, an adrenaline rush like I can't explain, you know, and there ain't no deer management with that. You're not
being very selective.
You're not being very selective, you know, as I've heard my uncle say plenty of times, you know, you just build a fence of bullets and hope they run into it.
That's right.
And but most of them guys did it not for killing anything. They wanted to hear a good race.
Yeah.
And so having a good dog was better than money. And because you could sit around and talk about a good dog for generations, money's gone, you know. And some of the finest men I ever knew, best storytellers I ever knew were dog hunters. Mm-hmm. They could tell a story. And it's kind of an art to telling a good story. Not everybody has honed their craft. I'm afraid I won't get off on a wild goose chase here, but I'm afraid our younger generations are losing that because of social media and texting and the lack of communication. But I'm going to tell you something. Telling a story, to me, will outlast most things, because people are going to remember a story mm-hmm. that they heard, you know, just like all of us sitting here right now. I could tell so many stories that we'd be here a week, and I'm not sure that a younger person could duplicate that, because mm-hmm. I don't know that they've soaked it all in or know how to articulate what they've seen, what they've experienced. So I'm extremely thankful to have been exposed to people that could tell stories, have some stories of my own, and so very yeah. important.
Yeah.
Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, a polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at WhitetailInstitute.com. That's WhitetailInstitute.com, and use code BEAR for 15% off. Sport Dog is the most recognized brand in the hunting dog training industry. Born in 2003 in Knoxville, Tennessee, Sport Dog was forged by a passionate group of hunters and dog trainers who intimately understood the challenges of the field and the special connection between hunters and their dogs. The people at Sport Dog know that having a well-trained hunting dog is more than just having a reliable partner. It's a commitment to their safety and unlocking their full potential. The Sport Dog promise to customers is simple: gear the way you design it. Every product Sport Dog builds is meticulously designed and rigorously tested in the field, ensuring it withstands the toughest conditions you and your dog may encounter. Trust Sport Dog, where innovation meets passion, to elevate your hunting experience and strengthen the bond with your local companion. Using tracking equipment on my squirrel and coon dogs is extremely important to me. To track my squirrel dogs and my one old coon dog that's not very good. Get 20% off your first purchase using the code BEARGREASE. Go to www.sportdog.com/BEARGREASE to learn more. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a goblin turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring.
Did y'all have any exposure to dog hunting, Aaron and Andy?
Very little, but we did have some.
So, listen, in Arkansas, there's like basically four regions of Arkansas. There's the Ozarks, there's the Ouachitas, which is a southern mountainous region. There's the Gulf Coastal Plain, and there's the Delta. It's not really four quadrants, but it's like that. In the mountains, well, I mean, 50 years ago, you could have run dogs anywhere in the whole state, and that would have been common throughout the southern United States. Running deer with dogs was the way that deer were hunted. And then gradually things changed. And dog hunting in the Delta, it was less practical there because of lots of private land. But in the Ozarks, I heard this from someone who knows the story, that in the 90s, there was a commissioner of the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission that lived in the Ozarks that just wanted dog hunting gone. And that was his agenda on his 7-year term as a game and fish officer, was to eliminate dog hunting in the Ozarks. And he did that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think one reason we weren't exposed as much is we hunted public land.
Yeah.
And I think just prior to when we really got to hunting, they banned hunting with dogs on public land.
Yeah, I think it was the early 90s.
You know, lots of times we'd be hunting and we could hear dogs that were joining the management area
on private,
and lots of times they'd run deer to us, or you know, be honest with you, I remember trying to sit close to those fence lines.
Well, there was one year that I don't know who pulled the strings. I don't know if it was Dad or who it was, got us into that joining property.
We did.
And so we could. I don't know how many. There were several hundred acres.
Yeah.
So I mean, we got in there, and
we did.
And that was my first chance or first opportunity to run dogs, and man, I remember it was awesome.
It was
excitement.
You killed a deer.
I killed two deer.
I killed a bobcat.
So when we left camp, I had never been exposed to that. So when we left camp, Dad looked at me and he said, you know, we're after meat. I mean, we need meat. You know, we're over here camped, we don't have any meat, and if you see a deer, you pull the trigger. And so here come them dogs. I could hear them, and man, I was excited. And, you know, of course, just like they told me, we're two does out in front of the dogs. And I had a lever action 30-30, open sights, and then they were two does. And which I don't know back then, I don't know what the laws were. But anyway, so these two does were out in front of these dogs. And it was probably 150, 175 yards away up the holler, and made the two best shots I've ever made in my life. The first one dropped, and second one I missed. And of course, I, you know, levered another one in there. And and I missed a second time. And the third shot, I got that next one. But man, it was awesome. I mean, we were all excited, and I was hoping to holler, and had a great time doing that.
I'd like to have got to do that more.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, to me, it's a lot. It's a lot bigger issue than just can you do it in one spot or not. When you look across the big traditions of hunting in North America, there's really not a lot of places where you can still run dogs. And I said on the podcast, I grew up as a bow hunter in an area where they could run dogs. And I killed a few deer in front of dogs hunting with the Cunninghams, some good friends of mine. And I loved it, but it's, you know, we didn't have deer dogs. That's not the way we hunted. Dad was a bow hunter. But now I am adamant. I mean, just I'll debate anybody in the world, Brent Reeves, on the importance, the cultural importance of keeping some of this stuff alive. I mean, and if you live in some area where they're running dogs and you don't want to have dogs, and I could talk about the pros and cons, and the cons would be dogs don't understand private property lines, and they just don't. And a deer's going to run somewhere, and a dog's going to follow it. Mm-hmm. And man, the way that was handled in the decades past, when people knew their neighbors, they understood kind of what people were doing, is they just kind of tolerated when a dog came across, or when it was just kind of a known thing, and it worked. They had a system that worked. And then as the world has changed, which it has a lot, people are moving into these rural areas. I mean, in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, where we all grew up, there wasn't a lot of
people, you know, were quote unquote, out of there.
Yeah, outside. Yeah, there was no reason to go there. Today, a lot of people buying recreational property in rural America everywhere, coming from different places. And so it's a lot more of a society that doesn't know each other. There was a system that worked, and it's much harder now. And even back then when I was a kid, I remember people that hated the dog runners, for sure. And in my mind, it's like, for what we're up against culturally, I love it. I love it. And I love that there's still a lot of dog running going on. A lot of families are still doing it. And even some younger generation of people that are still running dogs and whatnot.
Yeah, but it's not extinct. In some of the counties that you have a lot of national forest in, Scott, Montgomery, Polk, still a lot of dog hunters. You know, and I miss it just because, you know, it was something that generations of my family did.
Mm-hmm.
And still have, you know, the connection to the memories that were made doing all those things. And you know, I could probably reel off 90% of the dogs that my uncle and my dad owned. I could describe them to you, tell you their names and all those things. And it was the night before modern gun deer season, and my family was better than Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
Mm.
We'd gather at my grandparents' house. And my grandpa was a World War II veteran, hardest working man I ever knew, ever will know. He had no hobbies, zero, other than he liked to go deer hunting. And carried a shotgun, buckshot. He'd shoot the world down. I guess he shot at every deer ever seen. and didn't kill a lot. You know, he's kind of like, you know, kind of like Barney Brown. My grandpa was born, it was either 1916 or 1917. And one time, my grandpa was not one to throw a lot of kudos your way, a lot of compliments. He was a real tough guy. But I skinned a deer one day in front of him, and he said, "You know what you're doing right there." And that was maybe one of the first and only compliments I ever got from my grandfather. And golly, it meant the world to me, you know, that I had a skill that my grandpa thought was pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that year, I think in that one season, I killed more deer in one season than my grandpa did in his entire life. And my grandpa lived to be 83 years old.
Hmm.
So he was in that generation of where there were no deer at all. You know, I can remember a story. I can't remember who told this story, but I know it was true because I heard it from more than one person that somebody had not made it to church that Sunday morning, and on the wherever they were at, they seen a deer across the road, and they drove to the church house, kicked open the door, and announced to the congregation in the middle of the sermon, "I just seen a deer across the road," and everybody filtered out of the church house, went to the house, gathered the dogs, and the race commenced. And to the best of my knowledge, this occurred in like July. I mean, it was not even a hint of deer season. You know, season did not matter. They seen a deer. They're gonna do their best to try to collect it. So,
Brent, of the stories you heard, which one stood out to you? So there were seven stories on this episode.
Well, they were all good.
I figured you'd probably like mine the best.
Did you tell one? The apple story was great.
Dale Craig.
It was.
It was absolutely, it was wonderful. And while I was listening to it, I could see he told a story very well. And I could see when he dropped that apple, when the apple started rolling, I thought, oh, I know where this is going. Man.
Oh, did you think he was going to call the deer in?
I did. I really did. I thought this is going to be good. And it fell out. It went that way because I was reminded of a story a friend of mine told me 20 years ago when the snort wheeze craze just started coming out. Mm-hmm. You know, and he said,
you know, deer never did that before 2001.
Exactly. Before they started calling it. But he said, I bought one of these things. He said, I climbed up on my deer stand. He said, and I was sitting there. He said, when I first sat down on that stand, he said, I pulled it out of my pocket. He said, I didn't know which end of this thing to blow. He said, I just went, whew, and blowed in it like that. He said, and I looked at it, and the next thing I know, I mean, it was a good deer. It was a 140-inch deer come crashing through, and he shot him at the bottom of his stand just from that one little blow thing, you know, that he did. He said, and it wasn't even close to what it was sounded like. He said, but I heard it coming. So it reminded me of that story that I had
something unexpected
with.
Calling in a deer.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I killed a turkey one time in Missouri. I was crossing a fence, and I was a lot closer to that turkey than I thought. And when I put my hand on that barbed wire, it screeched in the staple. It went, meow. And a turkey gobble.
And I just remember you telling me that.
I sat down by the fence post, and 10 seconds later, a turkey poked his head up over a hill, and I killed him. So I know what that guy was dealing with.
Then. Yeah.
So
yeah.
I identified.
You know, this episode came together, and I had more. I've got twice as many stories as what's been told on this first one. And I cherry-picked, kind of entitled it, The Unexpected. Because every story, there was something unexpected that happened. From Dale's apple to Aaron peeing out of a tree, calling one in, to Mo Shepherd's mysterious deer in the tree, to Andy Brown's dad hitting one with a truck. Me, I threw mine in just because I could. Me hunting with my daughter down below me, which was just different.
That's the best story you have ever told.
You said that.
I loved it, man.
You know what I did? I told that story to Aaron. I learned a trick. A lot of times if I'm telling a story, I record it in here by myself. And he was here at the office. Aaron came here at the office to tell me a story. And I said, hey, let me tell you a story. And it was easier. It was easier to like kind of...
To
get
look
the vibe.
At somebody. Yeah.
I feel like you could do a part 2, 3, 4 through 30 on deer stories, and they would all be fantastic episodes. You know,
yeah.
They really do.
Well, I'm gonna make at least one more and maybe even two more. And you know, I could have done one on big bucks.
Sure.
Like I probably will at some point.
It's not near as fun.
Well, it would be. It could be though.
Maybe.
I mean, to hear everybody's like biggest buck story. Might do one on the deer that got away. You know, Dad tells a story on the next one of a big one that got away. It was a great story. I want to go back, though, to Dale Craig and the apple. When Dale Craig told me that story, I told him afterwards, I said, that's one of the best stories that I've ever heard told on this podcast. I thought that. Just the way it happened. That's the kind of story I like. But Dale Craig is the kind of guy that I can't say that he's never listened to a podcast, but it would not surprise me in the least if he said, Clay, I've never listened to a podcast in my life. I mean, you know Dale Craig, mm-hmm. Dad, you know him. He's a rural cattleman, cowboy, farrier, and I went to his house, and it's the first time I've been to his house. I kind of just have known him most of my life, and I went to school with his boys, but they were just kind of people I knew and always had a lot of respect for. And so I finally went to his house, and I said, man, I'd love to see some of your deer. And he was like, yeah, I got a few out here. And I mean, people like me have them hanging on the wall, like right here, you know, and if I meet you, I'm like, hey, you want to see my deer? Come in here. Dale was like, Yeah, I got a few. And we went out to a storage building, and he had some racks in there, and he pulled them out and set them in the grass. And, I mean, they were just all – just it was five or six, you know, 140 to 150-inch deer. And I was just like, oh, man, wow. And he's telling me the stories. You know, this one came from here, and this one came from here. Some of the places he could see from his house, he looking miles away into the mountains from his house, he'd say, that deer came from over there. And then he's like, come out here for a minute. And we walk into his barn. And these deer weren't up. I envisioned like just deer all over this barn. He had barrels full of racks that he probably hadn't looked at in 15 years that he starts pulling out. And I mean like deer that would be mounted on my wall. I mean like 135 to 150-inch deer. Just on the skull, he just.
Well, it meant something to him, or he wouldn't.
It reminded me of again. I'm kind of reminiscing on the Louis Dale and Charlie episodes, but the final episode of the Louis Dale and Charlie series, I asked Stoney Edwards. I said, "Do you have a bunch of the racks of the deer that your dad killed?" And he was like, "No." And I was like, "What do you mean you don't have any deer horns of your dad's?" And he said, "They didn't keep them." And I was just like, what? And he said, Clay, he said, when we'd have deer camp, he said, that week of deer camp, whoever killed the biggest deer was a big deal. It was as big a deal as anything in the world. And we'd have those racks sitting over there. And he said, when we started packing up deer camp, Dad would tell some kid, hey, if you want to take those horns home, you can. I mean, it just didn't mean anything to him. And these horns meant something to Dale. But my point is, this guy is a big buck killer. I mean, a big buck killer. And, you know, he's not advertising it to the world. He's not. I just went to him and cherry-picked some of his stories. But those are the kind of guys I like to have on the Bear Grease podcast. Guys like Luke and Aaron and Andy that hadn't been on many podcasts.
Boy, he's a good storyteller. He did a great job of that.
Yeah,
well, I'm going to tell you something. He is one of the hardest working human beings that's ever lived, and probably it'd be hard to argue this. Probably one of the most successful cattle ranchers around, and he is a working dude. And he has raised some hard working deer killing machines too. And his daughter's one of them. She's killed some thumpers, but he's taught all of his kids to live a life like him, hardworking, good hunters. Dale could sit around and tell you stories till the cows came home, literally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that was a good one. Andy, which of the stories did you like?
Man, I remember listening to the episode, I thought, man, this is, you know, I'm going to talk about this one. I mean, every one of these guys, you know, had something that really struck home with me. You know, I just went through a roller coaster of emotions throughout the whole episode, I felt like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of them were funny. Aaron's and Andy's were hilarious, you know. And
were you surprised when Andy's dad ran that deer over?
Unbelievable. Yeah. You know, to back over the thing again was just putting the icing on the cake for me. But, you know, back then, like he said, you know, there wasn't all that very many deer. So when you finally seen a deer, you did what you had to do
yeah.
to put meat on the table. So and that's just where we come from. And I really appreciate that episode or that Andy telling that story. But no, for me, you know, Luke, yours really, I mean, I just want to give you a big old bear hug when you finish.
Yeah,
you know, man, because I can relate with that. I mean, I have a six-year-old boy and I'm getting in, you know, he's finally getting into it, you know, and he's really wanting to be out there. And this is our first year, opening weekend of bow season was our first time to get out there. And, you know, every year previously, I've been shooting my bow a lot, you know, in the summer and getting ready and doing it all for me, but it's not about me right now. I just want to get him going. So I related to you, you know, so much. It's a huge sacrifice for you to let, you know, him pull the trigger on it. And yeah, I was basically just about in tears at the end of yours. Like I said, I just want to give you a big bear hug.
Yeah, I had a lot of feedback on yours, Luke. A lot of people really said it was a neat story.
It was. You did a really good job, Luke.
Yeah, appreciate it.
Yeah. Aaron, which one stood out to you? And you can't say Luke's now, okay? Luke's. You could say mine if you want. If mine stood out to you, that's fine. I'd like to hear about it. But we've given Luke all the credit he needs. I mean, this is his, like, second podcast, so I don't want him to, like, start thinking, hey, man, you know, man.
I'm too busy to be a podcaster, so
I liked all of them. I did. I didn't have a favorite. I did like the fact that Andy Brown said, he said, if we'd have met a car, we'd have just run over them.
Yeah.
Yeah. He meant it.
Yeah.
You know it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, on stories like Andy, I'm cutting you off. It'll be your turn in just a minute. To me, when I hear a good storyteller, it's always some obscure thing they say that isn't relevant, or, you know, isn't highly relevant that you never forget.
Yeah.
And Andy said, we were coming down through there and we're going so fast, we'd have just run over somebody if we'd have seen him. And
if we'd have met a car, we'd have run over him.
We'd have just run over him.
Yeah. It's like kids and cussing. You can be talking about anything and say one cuss word, and that's what the kid's going to go back in the house.
Yeah. How do you know that, Brent?
I'm just saying. I saw it on TV.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I liked Andy's honesty with his dad.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that. I enjoyed the history of his dad and what that meant, you know, to his dad. Killing a deer was a big deal. Fed their family. It was part of the sport, too, but, I mean, none of that deer went to waste. It would be totally unethical today, you know, to do something like that. But back then, it was a different time.
Yeah.
And, I enjoyed that. I really did.
I had to talk Andy into telling that story. So Scott told me, he said, man, you ought to get my dad to tell about Barney Brown in that particular story. And I had texted Andy, and he didn't respond back immediately, and he called me, and he said, Clay, if I tell that story, they're going to run us out of town, or, you know, something like that. And I said, I hear what you're saying, and I said, I don't want you to tell if you don't want to. I said, for real. But I said, I think we can give the context in such a way that it'll actually be really powerful, because that's where we came from, whether we want to acknowledge it or not.
It is what it is.
And I felt like he did such a good job of telling the context, the history of his dad. I mean, his dad going to prison and, you know, just the hard times, what it meant for them to kill a deer. I mean, just, it was perfect. I loved it. I loved it.
I did too.
Breaking into honesty. Lum and Abner's store. A lot of listeners might not know what he's talking about.
Right.
I mean, it's Lum and Abner. I mean, they were the star Hollywood people in probably, what, the 20s or so?
So the Dick, I'm glad you said that. So the Dick Huddleston store in Pine Ridge, Arkansas, was basically the home office of Lum and Abner, which was a national radio program that ran for 23 years in America. And these two... Basically, these guys, we talked about them on our Arkansas podcast, we did, but Lum and Abner were the face of the American hillbilly for 23 years when radio was the biggest thing.
Yeah.
I mean, they were national celebrities. Like, you would have recognized the President of the United States and Lum and Abner. And and they were based out of Pine Ridge, Arkansas, down there where we were at. And so the Dick Huddleston store was the Dick Huddleston Lum and Abner store.
The Jot'em, yeah. The Jot'em Down store.
Jot'em Down. It's still there today. It's incredible.
It's a museum now.
You put a post of that store
yeah.
a couple months ago.
Yeah.
So, Barney, he knew how to pick them, man.
Yeah.
You know, do I get the little grocery store down here or the Lumen Abner store? Sir?
Yeah. Well, I thought it was interesting that they turned himself in. Like yeah. He went and told his uncle, you know, boy, I'd like to hear how that story went. You know,
yeah, yeah.
What happened there? But no, that was probably. I'm kind of like. Well, a couple of you have said all of them. All the stories were really meaningful. Andy's was probably my favorite, just because it was so unique.
He's just so gifted as a storyteller.
Yeah,
it's yes.
Yeah.
He's one of the best storytellers I've ever heard.
Yeah, well, yeah.
I've known Andy my entire life. Spent a lot of time hunting with him, worked with him for almost 11 years, and that guy can tell a story like nobody else. And you can see the same thing. You can be standing right next to him, see the same thing, and he tells that story, and you're sitting there going, man, that is a – at times you'll be like, "No, wait a minute, was I there?"
Yeah.
You know, Scott's got it too.
It's got a little more zest. To
yeah.
It.
Yeah,
yeah.
And oh yeah,
Scott's got some of the same.
Yeah, Scott can tell. He can tell a good story, but Andy could sit around and tell you countless stories about his dad, about all of his wild youth, and all the hunting trips he's been on, and he's. I know he won't be offended to me telling this, but he is literally a calamity just waiting to happen. And, you know, he's notorious for dropping stuff out of the tree stand. In fact, he dropped his light out of his tree stand 2 days ago, you know, and it's shining up in the tree right at him. You know, so
crawl down and get it.
Yeah, he crawled down, got it. But, you know, he come by it honest. His dad, Barney, was a storyteller. Barney was... he was full of it. I mean, he could put a little icing on the cake, and but anyway, that
well, it's a unique intersection with somebody with a high level of competency and a high level of ability to tell a story come together.
Yeah,
because anybody could, I mean, you could go to school and learn how to tell a story, or. You know, I mean, storytelling's a big deal in the world, really, when you look at just even television. I mean, everything is a story. But when you have somebody like Andy, who's a veteran hunter and is a what I would say, I mean, I would 100% say, I mean, he's a bona fide woodsman. For the woods he hunts, he knows what's going on. And so when those two things meet, it's
pretty
unique.
Special.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whenever I look at pictures of my kids from the past year or even just a few months ago, I'm so amazed at how fast they're growing up, and then it hits me hard. I'm getting older too. That's why planning for my family's financial security has become a top priority. Making sure we're prepared and having enough life insurance in case something unexpected happens and I'm out of the picture is crucial. And Fabric by Gerber Life makes it simple to get the protection that's right for your family. Fabric by Gerber Life was designed by parents and for parents to help you get a high quality, surprisingly affordable term life insurance policy in less than 10 minutes. You could go from start to covered in less than 10 minutes with no health exam required. There's no risk to apply. They have a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/bear. That's M-E-E-T, fabric.com/bear, meetfabric.com/bear. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Assurance Company, not available in certain states. Prices subject to underwriting and health questions. Whitetail Institute launched the food plot revolution in 1988 with a concentration on research and real-world testing of forage products specifically for whitetail deer. Whitetail Institute's research and development team of agronomy experts provide effective, personalized service. I've been using Imperial Whitetail Clover for a long time in a food plot back behind my house. In 2007, I killed the biggest buck of my life over an Imperial Whitetail Clover small quarter-acre food plot. Imperial Whitetail Clover is the only clover scientifically developed through years of selective breeding. Clover Extreme genetic stability provides extreme cold tolerance, disease, and drought tolerance. It really does. Clover is coated with Whitetail Institute's Rain Bond, a polymer coating added for enhanced seedling survivability. They have an exclusive offer for Bear Grease listeners, 15% off Imperial Clover when you use the code BEAR at WhitetailInstitute.com. That's WhitetailInstitute.com and use code BEAR for 15% off. Sport Dog is the most recognized brand in the hunting dog training industry. Born in 2003 in Knoxville, Tennessee, Sport Dog was forged by a passionate group of hunters and dog trainers who intimately understood the challenges of the field and the special connection between hunters and their dogs. The people at Sport Dog know that having a well-trained hunting dog is more than just having a reliable partner. It's a commitment to their safety and unlocking their full potential. The Sport Dog promise to customers is simple: gear the way you design it. Every product Sport Dog builds is meticulously designed and rigorously tested in the field, ensuring it withstands the toughest conditions you and your dog may encounter. Trust Sport Dog, where innovation meets passion, to elevate your hunting experience and strengthen the bond with your local companion. Using tracking equipment on my squirrel and coon dogs is extremely important to me. To track my squirrel dogs and my one old coon dog that's not very good. Get 20% off your first purchase using the code BEARGREASE. Go to www.sportdog.com/BEARGREASE to learn more.
Dad, which one stood out to you?
No question. They were all pretty boring until Willow Newcomb came up, my granddaughter. Now, I tell you what, I was
Did
really...
you remember that story?
No, I did not.
It's not one I've really thought about that much.
I don't even know. I probably didn't even know what happened. But, it was pretty neat in that you accomplished a lot there. You held up your duties as a father, and you twisted it to where you could deer hunt. Yeah. I think we've all done that one way or the other. But probably... I'm like you guys. Every story was just unbelievable. But I would go with Mo Shepherd.
Really?
I mean, you find your deer up in a tree.
Yeah.
And another thing I liked about it, I'm out of that age where I don't know how to corn hunt. I don't know how to put a camera on the side of a tree. I just go out and hunt deer. Mm-hmm. And that's what he was doing. He was out there just hunting deer the old-fashioned way, and he killed that buck and a mountain lion, pulled it up in that tree. I just almost 100% sure.
Or a black panther.
It could have been a black panther, like Clay
said. that was part of Mo's story that if you were paying attention, you would have caught something. He said there were deer in that area in the fall, and he hadn't even been in there scouting, but he knew when the ice came that those deer were going to be in those old home places with a greenbrier above the ice. That's a good woodsman.
Yeah.
Like he knew. He didn't even have to go scout. He's just like, there'll be deer there.
He wasn't hunting a pinch point or a trail. I mean, he was hunting where they were going to eat, and I can relate to that. So,
yep.
Anyway.
That was a significant ice storm that year. Yes. I told you the story the other day.
I remember it well, too.
I told you the story the other day of that same ice storm.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they were
bad.
Starving. It was bad.
Yeah.
They had cutout trails on that ice. That's the only place they could walk. If they got off those cutout trails, they were slipping and sliding everywhere.
Wow. What do y'all think happened to his deer? I mean, there's debate. You could debate, and it would just be speculation of, did a animal drag his deer from that pool of blood? Because, I mean, a question I would have had for him is like, well, wouldn't you have seen drag marks through the ice? Like if the deer had been laying there and something carried it off, but the ice was so hard that it wasn't like snow. So But there is not a beast in these woods that carries, like a jaguar or a leopard, carries stuff up in trees to eat. I mean, even a mountain lion doesn't do that. A bear doesn't do it.
Oh, you were serious when you said they don't do that. Yeah, I thought you were sure.
Could they?
I know they do.
Black
panther will.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm saying some animal acted outside of its norm. What do y'all think happened? Anybody have any?
Hey, I got the answer. I know what happened. I mean, I know black panthers and I know mountain lions. That mountain lion caught that deer right where the big block of blood was.
Yeah,
and he knew if he drug it off, every animal in the woods would follow that trail. So he ate quite a bit of it, cleaned the blood up, was real neat, drug it off.
Okay. Crime scene.
Drug it up in that tree.
Cleaned okay.
up the crime scene. He was probably a black panther, but I don't know. That could be crazy, but I just know it could be the deer. We all, almost every deer I've had to track, I don't like tracking them. They're going to do that.
They're going to run.
They're going to lay down. They're going to bleed. They're going to jump. And then the blood gets real thin. So the deer probably laid down, something scared it, it jumped, ran off, and then the mountain lion came in, drug it up that tree.
Oh, that's a good, maybe it jumped it and then it killed it somewhere else.
Yeah.
Now, the other part of the story was that it was real steep country, and Mo went downhill looking for that deer. He kind of made an emphasis that he didn't go uphill, but that deer was two benches up.
Yeah.
But what do you think, Aaron?
Will a bobcat do that?
I mean, no. But
a bobcat won't do that.
I mean, they don't. It's not typical for, and I mean, I'm not a bobcat. Well, I am a bobcat expert. I mean, look at me. They're not a leopard or a African, a jaguar or a leopard will take kills up in a tree. I mean, right. Typically, I don't think a bobcat's going to do that.
I don't think they're big enough.
Yeah.
No, not as big as that deer was. I thought maybe, I had to back up. I thought, well, he shot the deer and it jumped off that bench and lit in a tree.
Mm.
But it was up above where he shot him. Correct?
Yeah.
So I went back and I thought, well, dang, Mo, I got your answer. I'm fixing to call you up. And I thought, wait a minute. Maybe it was above. And so I went back and listened to it again. And yeah, it was above where he shot it.
Hmm.
So the only other thing other than something dragging it up in that tree is it makes a loop and jumps.
And yeah, I bet if Mo was here, I bet he'd tell you that physically wouldn't be possible. I mean,
I'm just having to picture how he's describing it, you know.
Yeah.
So
I found a deadhead one time about 15 feet up in a tree. I have no idea how it got up there. It was tangled in like small branches.
Deer head?
Yeah, a deer head way up in a tree. Mm-hmm. It probably wasn't 15 feet.
We've got a lot of bald eagles. You know, the deer may have ran off. The deer may have ran off and died. Mo may not have found it. It may have rotted there on the ground and buzzards, coons, everything might have chewed it up for days, and then an old bald eagle may have come in there and grabbed it, or I don't know. I mean, and put up in the tree.
A melanistic bald eagle. Black.
There you go. Yeah. There you go.
What you got, Dad?
You're right. I didn't know this. Mountain lions do not carry prey up trees. So there you go. I've been wrong my whole life.
I didn't say black panther.
You're right about the airplane,
But here's the thing: is that in all animals, there's a typical way in which they're going to act. And would a mountain lion be capable of carrying a deer up a tree? 100%. And the thing that's not up for debate is that something carried that up a tree, and it wasn't a human. I mean, it's like a human didn't do it; an animal did it. So something did it that was here, and then. It was pretty compelling to hear him say 3 years later he saw a mountain lion. And, you know, for those of you guys that don't know Mo, in my mind, Mo is, like, highly credible in terms of any way I evaluate someone in the woods. I mean, like, he's the real deal, like a lot of these guys that I'm talking about. And so, I mean, he tells me he sees a mountain lion, I believe him. Just interesting story.
Yeah, when you spend as many hours in the woods as a guy like him, you're going to have a story like that. I mean, everything happens to you, you know.
Yeah.
So that was a great
Have you ever seen a mountain lion?
No, but he has.
Have you?
You have seen one in Kansas.
Oh, I have. Absolutely.
You forgot.
I did. I wouldn't. Well, I was thinking around here. Yeah. 12:30 in the afternoon, 80 degrees, middle of Kansas, wide open cattle pasture, both sides of the road. Andy and I are driving down the dirt road, and a cat jumps the road. I don't know if he landed once or twice, like, but he
jumped a fence.
Jumps the fence, hits the road, jumps again over the fence, and just goes right out across the pasture and was gone. Middle of the day. And there was no question what it was.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Probably 2010, just guessing.
Really?
Yeah. Sure enough.
Have you seen one in Arkansas, you think, Andy?
So my cousin Jared and I were bow hunting around Eureka Springs. And the guy that owned the local bow shop, whatever his name, I can't remember.
Still got the bow shop over around the Beaver Dam.
Okay.
Anyway, he had pictures of some cattle that had some claw marks on the hams of the cattle. And so anyway, knowing that, we got permission to bow hunt on him. And yeah, so we were just sitting there bow hunting, and a doe come running through the field out of the woods. Just really, you know, running hard. And we thought, what in the world, you know? And so it wasn't all that far away. I wish Jared was here too to confirm the story, but because it seems like you always need two people to confirm it. But
yeah, we're not going to believe you. Unless see, I
know.
Jared.
But sure enough, you know, here come a big cat, and it was right. It's a pasture. So
you saw it plain as day.
Plain as day, running over after this doe, up over the hill, and that was that. Wow. So as we sat there, Jared, he always had a predator call in his pocket, and he thought it'd be funny or smart to try to call this thing in. He started, you know, on this call, and like, what in the world are you doing? You know?
Yeah.
I was trying to get the heck out of there.
That's the last time I'm home with Jared.
Yeah.
But sure enough, it didn't come back.
Didn't come back.
Well, interesting. I've never seen one in Arkansas. I've seen them in different parts of the world. But Luke, which story stood out to you?
Well, just like the rest of you guys, they all stood out to me. The dog hunting connection with Travis.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed it because talking about transitioning from being a lifer, dog hunter, going all the way to the mountains to try this new method of hunting with Dale, and to end up right back in a dog race.
Yeah.
And because I've been in several situations exactly like that. You know, I'm off, you know, in the 90s and the early 2000s trying to still hunt. You hear in the distance, you hear that dog open, and immediately you start looking to man the battle station, because you know, by golly, I'm sitting in the right spot right here, and a lot of times, here they come.
Everything changes when you hear a dog, too.
Guarantee it does. Yeah. If you're carrying a lever gun, the hammer's getting cocked, the safety's getting snapped off, you're shouldering your gun, trying to get all comfortable, and because when it happens, it's like quick. That, and you're shooting skills and all those things, out the window they go, and you just sling as much ammunition towards them as you can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Isaac, what was your favorite story?
Peeing out of the tree. Gave me validation.
Peeing out of the tree gave Isaac validation.
It made me feel good.
I've heard
it gave you some relief, didn't it?
I've heard that story. I've heard that story for years, and it was the first time I heard it straight from you. You're pretty sure you damaged your bladder, huh?
I spent a lot of hours in a tree stand. I mean, I used to hunt a lot, and I didn't know any better. You know, I'd hold it, and I remember holding it so bad I would just get to hurting, and I don't do that anymore, but. I carry a bottle now. I don't know what everybody else does, but yeah, I think I damaged my bladder as a kid just holding it, because I just knew that if I was to go to the bathroom, the deer would smell me, and then I wouldn't get to kill a deer, you know. But that particular day, that all worked out. That was I'll never forget that. And they come in just like you had a breadcrumbs through the woods, you know. The part that he didn't tell was he calls me and he says, hey, I've shot some deer, you know. So it was getting dark and I drove up there and he's sitting there on the side of the road, sitting on top of his climbing tree stand. I said, well, Aaron, you know, where's your deer at? He gets up, picks up his climbing tree stand, and both of those deer are underneath that climbing tree stand. That's how big these
Hey, that
you, didn't have to tell that part.
Well, hey, that's my favorite part of this story. I mean, it was a big deal.
Oh.
Lots of my life, to this day probably, if I wasn't after a big buck, man, a yearling deer comes by.
Oh.
The idea that you wouldn't shoot a yearling is beyond me.
There was no chance I'd have passed them up. I mean, that was a big deal. No, we were fired up to kill one. I killed two. Yeah. I was talking to camp. It didn't matter if they were yearlings or not. Hey, you know,
that was my favorite part about that story. And you remember what I said? Do you remember how I introduced him?
Oh yeah.
This man has killed as of 2 days ago, 25 deer that
you
would score over
the
Pope
story to me that, you know, you got a big time deer hunter here, but when he gets started, there's not as many deer back then. So, I mean, to kill two deer in one day, I could relate to that, man. I mean, when I started in 77, holy cow, the entire city of Hot Springs, there was only two of us that could kill a deer with a bow and arrow. The gun hunter guys didn't know how to do it. Yeah. You know, they were raised in deer camps. They didn't know how to kill a deer with a bow, and I didn't even know how to hunt. But it just hit me one day, hey, if I'm hunting humans, I'm going to go into McDonald's, and I'm going to find a McDonald's. And so it was real easy for me to kill deer. And if I could kill two little deer, I told this story. I don't know if it's on a podcast, but I'm sitting in a stand one day, and a big doe comes out, boy, and I'm getting all ready. I'm going to nail her. And I look back, and she's got a smaller doe behind her. And I'm thinking, okay, easier to get to the truck, better meat. Well, I look back, and there's two more. And the last one was the small one. So I let them all walk, and I whacked that little guy.
See? This is where I come from. Yeah. There is no zero shame in killing small deer.
Absolutely.
I mean, as long as it's within the boundaries of the law.
Hey, I got another deal that might be good for some of the young guys. You set your goals in life, and many, many times you set them way too low. But because I started in the 70s, my goal, and I didn't know how to deer hunt, my goal was to kill a deer every year with a bow and arrow. All my buddies thought it was funny. My dad thought it was funny. Everybody just laughed at me. So my goal was to kill a deer with a bow and arrow. So when it got up to where you guys were coming on killing big bucks, hey, I was still happy to kill a doe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Where if I'd have said I'm going to be a big buck hunter, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, no, you always said that to me, and that made a lot of sense. And it also... But what I've seen you do, though, is stay true to your roots and not really be influenced by what society said was valuable. And I kind of live in both worlds. Like, you know, I mean, I love to target a mature deer and try to kill him, and that's real important to me. But I also very quickly can turn into a doe hunter and go out and shoot a doe, and it just be like a big deal. And it comes from that. And yeah, what you would, the trend of the age is, and especially now that we have exponentially more deer than we used to have, there's more options. They're, you know, and it's kind of funny. It's like something happened about 2005, 2010, and everybody and their mom could kill a deer with a bow. I mean, and it happened probably because of just more people were doing it. It happened because there was more information about how to do it.
The technique changed about that time.
Yeah, and in states where you could bait, I mean, where you can bait a deer on private land,
absolutely.
And it's happened around here. I mean,
it
people
changed
use
the harvest
corn
numbers.
To kill deer.
Absolutely.
And we
can talk about that another time. But that,
yeah,
it changed the way deer hunting is today.
Yeah.
probably for the worse, but that's a discussion we can have some other time. But prior to that, I didn't know people baited deer at all. I mean,
no, it just wasn't a thing. It was something that you heard that happened in South Texas.
Yeah, we hunted. We'd hunt for days to see a deer.
Yeah,
I can go get a fourth grader right now, put him in a blind with a crossbow over a corn pile, and he can harvest a deer this afternoon. And he's never shot a crossbow before today.
Yeah,
that was unheard of in our day. It's just the way things have changed, and it's good or bad. It is what it is.
Yeah, no doubt.
Aaron, I think that like when you and I first met, you thought you didn't have very many deer. Coming from where I was from, first time y'all took me hunting, I thought I had died and went to heaven.
I remember that.
I mean, because I saw more than one deer.
I remember that. Yeah.
I saw six or seven deer. You know what I mean? I'm like, by golly. So, fact. The first, I told this to Clay when we were talking about how you and I met and everything. The first day we ever hunted together, Aaron killed an 11-point buck. Shot him in the throat.
I mounted that deer. Still got it in my shop.
Yeah. I said, well, what happened? He goes, well, that's what I could see. I'm like, good enough.
It worked. I was so proud of that deer. That's the biggest buck that's ever lived. It probably 95 inches. I mean, I was so proud of him.
I was gonna bring up, Aaron killed 2 days ago, Dad, 147-inch deer with his bow here.
Really? That's amazing, man. I really congratulate people that do that. But hey, one thing I did, I was so impatient. If a deer walked up, I'm going to kill it, knowing that if I'd sit there all day, a buck probably would walk in. And the way I hunted, I had several big bucks come in, usually October 20th through November the 5th, and just it wasn't meant for me to kill them. I mean, I very seldom ever missed a deer. They usually dropped within 50 yards, but a big buck would come in. I wouldn't even be nervous, you know, and I'd just do all this kind of stuff and finally get on it and forget it's at 30 yards and I got my 20 pin, stuff like that just happened.
And you were hunting public land too. I don't think you ever killed a deer on private land. Probably you probably did one or two.
Maybe in Texas. I went on a Texas hunt a couple times where I did, but anyway, and another thing, most of you guys would be embarrassed to tell this. I'm not, but I was afraid of heights. I jumped off a big old building when I was 10 years old, and I think that's why I had my knees replaced. And I mean, I could not stand up on a stand. I could not shoot to the back. I couldn't shoot. I let so many deer go on the left-hand side. I just let them walk. I mean, I hunted for the deer to be right here. I didn't even want them in front. I wanted them right there. And so, I mean, I think about all the deer I killed. I probably could have killed twice that many if I could have stood up and turned. And as I got the last 5 years, I got a little bit over that. But it's kind of everybody's got their own little niche. And you got the big bucks, and I know you killed a bunch of big bucks.
Yeah. Brent, you did a deer stories. So this country life, deer camp stories.
Mm-hmm.
Deer camp.
Did you bring us any of that bologna?
Man, let me tell you, Pettigene bologna made right here in Arkansas. But the pepper relish, that was the trick. That was good. Good stuff.
It sounded good to me, man.
I thought it was funny. He said he still had his mouth full. He was chewing as fast as he could when he walked up there. He wanted to make sure his buddy didn't get any of that sandwich.
Yeah, that's my nephew. That's my nephew.
You'd have to be hungry if Brent had half a bologna and relish sandwich, and you walked up to him, and you were like, hey, do you mind if I have the rest of that?
Well, that's my nephew. Now, he's twice as tall as I am, and he would eat it, I'm sure.
That's funny. Well, shoot, guys, this has been good. Been real good. This is just the beginning of the Deer Stories podcast. This is always one of my favorite times of the year because I get to go and meet with guys. I mean, just like Luca came down to where you live, met with you. Aaron came over here. Dad's got a story. I went and saw Andy. I went and saw Mo. I mean, you know, just like it's kind of like for me, it's a lot of fun gathering up all these stories. I'm interested in other people's stories too. It's hard in some ways doing what I'm doing is it's kind of a bummer because there's a lot of great people that listen to this podcast that hear these stories and are like, oh, they need to, Clay needs to hear this story.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's very difficult to like parse through. Like if you message me, you're like, Clay, I got a great story. You probably do. I know you do.
I tell you what I'm interested in. I would like to hear, does Willow remember that? I would love.
I actually brought it up to her. I told her, I said, Willow, you're on the podcast this week. And I told her, and she, I don't think she has any recollection of that.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Because that, the whole time I was listening to it, and I sent you a text when I listened to it, that's the best story you have ever told. And I was there with you when we told the world the story about the bear slipping in on us.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that to me was the best story.
Was it the story or the way told it, or both?
It had to be a combination of all of it. Because I could see the whole thing playing out. Because, I know you, obviously, and Willow. And I could see her, and I've seen pictures of her when she was that age, and I could see all that playing out in my head because I would take my oldest daughter, Amy, with me when we would go duck hunting,
mm-hmm.
and she'd be sitting in the blind. Mm-hmm. Or I'd take Bailey with me now, you know, and she would, at that age, and she'd just be playing and coloring and just having a ball and while I'm trying to kill a deer. But really just spending time with them. But to hear hear my daughter, Amy, and to hear Bailey or my son, Hunter, tell a story from their viewpoint of a story that I've told with them with me.
Yeah.
It's different. They see a whole different thing, and it's, to me, it's a better story. So I hate that she don't remember it because that's the story I would love to hear.
I thought about it. I think it was just like, I'm not trying to say that we did that kind of stuff all the time, mm-hmm. but we did that stuff all the time.
Right.
I mean, I think it was just like a Tuesday.
Yeah.
I mean, it was special because we killed a deer, and it was special because I, you know, just the unique, I never did that again just like that. But, I mean, they went with me a lot.
Well, it was just perfect. It was a perfect story.
Yeah.
Where you were at was perfect. It was good.
I thought about, too, a photo. I've taken a picture of almost every deer that I've ever killed. And I cannot find that picture. And I think it was the beginning of the digital age for me when I went from actual taking real photos mm-hmm. that you went to develop. And I think we took pictures of that on a cell phone, and they just are gone. And it was before social media. I wasn't on social media then, or nobody was, I guess, 2006 to speak of. And so I think now I can go back 12 years into social media and find pictures, which is risky because, I mean, who's to say Facebook's going to be around tomorrow? I mean, but anyway, it was a gap of about 5 years where I hardly have any pictures.
I know you're running out of time, but I'm the grandpa. Let me tell you something that really impressed me is you got a little girl that's real compliant and real smart. Mm-hmm. And you just say, you've got to do these things. And she goes, okay. And she did them. Your little boy, you got a little boy?
When he was four years old, he'd be throwing rocks.
I mean, you know, he'd be going, just forget totally what the instructions are.
Yeah.
And start pitching rocks in the creek. Yeah. Hey, Daddy, watch this. Would have totally blown it. But Willow. Yeah.
She
followed the rules.
She did. You know, I actually thought about another hunt that took place in almost the same spot, different scenario with my two youngest sons, Bear and Shepherd. That didn't turn out so good. It was in that same field, but we had a blind. I actually had a pop-up blind, and I don't remember the scenario, but I had both the boys in there, and they were probably 3 and 5. So it'd been a couple years later because the sister's older. And I remember seeing some deer way off, like a quarter mile away off, like 20 minutes before dark, and the deer weren't going to make it. And I had a bow. And I told the boys, I said, boys, y'all stay here. I'm going to go try to get that deer. And I had them stay in the blind. And I slipped out the back and went and stalked these deer and was gone for way longer than I thought I was going to be. And when I came back, I heard Shepherd just crying in the blind, just bawling. I mean, for like 300 yards away, I could hear him. And I was like, oh, no. And I went over there, and they got scared. They got scared, you know. But I could, they could have seen me the whole time. I was never out of sight of that blind. But I was a long ways off, and so they lost track of me. And then I was on these deer, Aaron. I mean, I was like about to kill them, and it got dark on me, you know, and I went back. I felt terrible. I mean, to the point I just like almost cried because I could hear him from – anyway, that was a nightmare, and I learned something on that one. I really did, like, because I was like, I will never do that again, and, you know, leaving a kid because – my dad, I don't know if I ever told y'all about my dad, but my dad wasn't afraid at all to leave me in the woods for long in the dark. And I would get scared as could be. But I'm kidding, Dad. I'm not kidding.
Well, no, I did it that way. And you know what? A lot of it had to do with I didn't know how to hunt. Everybody thought you couldn't kill a deer. And I was so committed to kill a deer that I wasn't going to, I mean, you know, I'm going to kill a deer. And I don't know if we got time. You can cut this out.
No, we got
but
time.
But I won't tell these dead gum followers of yours what a wimp you are. He's 10 years old.
It's
it
true.
Bothers me to see him 13, 15 years old. He kills his first deer. Well, at 10 years old, I got the best spot in the whole stinking world, man. I mean, I hunted 40 years. This spot was the spot. I mean, you had everything there you wanted. 60 piles of droppings, everything.
Wide
I mean,
okay, I counted under them. A single acorn tree.
I counted them. And so I put a stand up in there. Everything was set up perfect. 10 years old. We had to be back to town by like 10 o'clock. I need to kill a deer because I'm only hunting on Saturdays, you know. And maybe Sunday morning occasionally. And so I walk him in here, and I go, okay, right there, Clay. He climbs up in that tree.
It's black dark.
And so I turn around to walk off, and I hear him crying. You know, most daddies would have said, hey, don't worry about it, Clay. I'm going to get over here in the corner and sit down in that bush, and I'm going to be right here the whole time. But – that never entered my mind because I got one day to kill this deer, and if this little dirt ball won't set up there,
kids
so I put
everything.
Him in the car and the truck, and we went over and I shot that little deer, and I got my goal done for the year, and I'm ready to quit now. So, but that was the craziest stand I'd ever seen, and you don't see that anymore.
No.
It's when you guys came up and started hunting. You couldn't find stuff like that. But for some reason, first 10 years I hunted, to see 30, 40, 15 piles of droppings under a white oak tree was very common. 60 was kind of unusual.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what. If you'd have come in there, there'd have been a whole herd of little does walk in. So
no, that hunt, it's a wonder I made it through. Because it was the first time I'd hunted by myself. And I mean, it's like probably an hour and a half before daylight because he had to go drive 10 miles to get to his. It's not like we were hunting like down the ridge. He was going somewhere else. It's just the way we had to hunt because there were just two good spots and they happened to be miles apart. I don't remember the details, but he put me up in that stand and I was just like,
no,
bro. Oh, I cried like I was scared. I was in the fourth grade and never hunted by myself. And, oh, yeah. It was intense.
But really, you were so tough. He was so tough. We would scout a lot of times on four-wheelers, fast four-wheelers. I mean, we'd be running through the woods going, right here's a spot. Anyway, and he'd be right. Might take him a while to catch up. You know, me and my buddy, we'd do that a lot of times just for the fun of it. But it's a real effective way of scouting. And Clay would be right there with us. Never wore out. Just wouldn't quit. So I thought, man, put him in a tree. Holy cow, this would be easy.
Big baby.
Got scared.
Clay, I'd like to say something before we wrap this up because it sounds like we're coming to a close here. I want to say thank you for us getting together. I have to thank our friend Scott Brown for getting us together.
Mm-hmm.
Scott's one of the – he's one of the best hunters, woodsmen. He does not hunt bait. He does not go and travel all over the country hunting. He hunts some of the, in my opinion, some of the worst places you could go to go deer hunting. But that sucker is consistent. He'll kill deer when nobody else will. He's the real deal hunter. But he got us together, and in doing so, I'm sitting here today, sitting across from a couple of guys that I've realized sitting here, I've missed y'all a lot. And as I'm walking up, Aaron's like, how long has it been? It's been over 20 years.
It's been over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
And my goodness, life will just fly right on by, right in front of you. And I think of all the things that have happened since the last time we seen each other till today, a lot. I mean, both my folks are gone. Both my brothers are gone. You know, I've married and got stepsons and, you know, and done all these different things. And I know y'all, you know, probably done the same. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, I'm grateful that you shot me a text, you know, and said, hey, you want to tell a deer story? And I'm like, I sure do. You know, not knowing if I was going to be sitting right here looking at you two boys.
Before we got here, Luke, I was thinking of the very same thing, how a white-tailed deer can bring us back together, you know, and bring us together in the first place.
Yes.
You know? Mm-hmm. If you hadn't had that high country shirt on,
yeah,
we probably wouldn't be here together.
And that was in the fall of 1997 when Aaron and I both – We were both transfer students going to Fayetteville.
Yeah.
Not knowing a soul. I mean, I didn't know anybody.
I didn't either.
What you said at the end of your story, I thought was really powerful in that, I mean, it's not, there's nothing about a white-tailed deer that is going to cause somebody to have there's nothing magical. And we talk about a deer being magical and all this stuff. We love to hunt. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But really what brought us together, because what's valuable is a human relationship.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. And all the everything that I do inside of Bear Grease and stuff, really, we're talking about deer hunting. We're talking about the land. We're talking about rivers. We're talking about mountains and lions and deer, like all this natural stuff. But really what's interesting to me is how humans interact with that and then how humans interact together around those things, like the relationships that we have. And you did such a good job of saying, you know, a white-tailed deer is really what brought us all together and becomes a medium to which you can exchange and have relationship. Like you'd have a bond. Like I hadn't seen Eric. Well, I saw you 10 years ago. I hadn't seen Andy in probably 20 years. And I mean, me and you, we can, anytime we see each other, it's like we got a connection, and it's deer, but it's bigger than that. And that's special.
It is.
That's special. And I'm sure there are other things in the world that people can connect over, but there is nothing in the world that is more in order or I could even use the word primal than the hunting connection between humans. I mean, that is the bond that made the human species was hunters connect. I mean, really, when you, if you just like boiled it down to like, I have to be safe and warm and have shelter. I have to reproduce and find a wife, and I have to kill stuff to eat. Maybe you could throw in a little bit later, I got to find some land to grow some crops on. I mean, it's like pretty basic level human stuff. So for us to come together and talk about deer hunting and how it's connected us is like, I love it. So.
Yep.
Yeah, I thought you did a good job of saying that.
I appreciate it.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Thank you for having us on. It's been fun.
Thank you
very much. Yeah, well, we'll do it again. Brent, closing words, wisdom, go. 1, 2, 3.
I talked about it in my podcast. It's tradition and legacy and the value of sharing something good with people that you love and people that you like. There was... I don't remember how many stories were on this podcast.
7.
There were 7 examples of everything right there. It was good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's it for me.
Excellent. Thank you all for coming. Great to see everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
Sport Dog is the most recognized brand in the hunting dog training industry. The Sport Dog promise to customers is simple. Gear the way you design it. Every product Sport Dog builds is meticulously designed and rigorously tested in the field, ensuring it withstands the toughest conditions you and your dog may encounter. Using tracking equipment on my squirrel and coon dogs is extremely important to me. Get 20% off your first purchase using the code BEARGREASE. Go to www.sportdog.com/BEARGREASE to learn more.